Welcome to EIR Talks. On September 2, 2001, EIR's circulation manager, Stanley Ezrol, addressed the Schiller Institute conference in Reston, Virginia. Ezrol exposed the seedy story of the Confederacy today, focusing on the role of William Yandell Elliott and his circle of friends known as the Nashville Agrarians, or simply, the Fugitives. Elliott, as you will hear, was the Harvard University mentor of both Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Here's Stanley Ezrol, whose speech was entitled, It Only Smells Like the Island of Dr. Moreau.
So the main problem to be solved tonight or worked on tonight is why people aren't having more fun. In order to do that, I'm going to give you a little bit of a map of enemy terrain, namely the terrain inside your minds and the minds of the people that you deal with who are not having the fun that they ought to be having. The thing that I want to start by reminding some of you of, most of you are somewhat familiar with the Alma Gantry film and the image of Burt Lancaster down on all fours in church barking like a dog. Most of you do not get down on your knees on all four in church and bark like dogs, and most of the people that you meet with don't do that on a regular basis. However, there are many people you meet with, maybe even some people here in this room tonight, who think that Fat Albert Gore is a more viable candidate for president than Lyndon LaRouche. There are many people who think that George W. Bush's advisors, there are some people who even think that George W. Bush is smart enough to fix things before it comes to a calamity like a world war or a total financial meltdown. That's sort of in the class of getting on your knees and barking like a dog. But there are a lot of people who aren't quite that bad, but who think, well, his people wouldn't let him do that. There are a lot of people who think that a system of strong sovereign nation states dedicated to protecting the general welfare of their citizens is oppressive big government, and we ought to do something to control it. A lot of people think that the United States has a concern with foreign enemies, rogue states, China, Russia, terrorist threats. A lot of people think those enemies are more dangerous than the internal enemy that I told you we had to deal with tonight. Now, what I hope we can accomplish this evening is to give you enough of the sense of smell, not by releasing any odors in the hall, but by generating that smell in your mind's nose, so to speak, so that when you see these views that I've outlined within yourself or within the people you talk to, you will think, ah, there you are down on all fours, barking like a dog. Now, what we've got up here is a group of fellows. Actually, the point that was taken, they were not as old as they look. They're known as the Fugitive Poets, the Nashville Agrarians. They are, for the most part, third-generation descendants of the Tennessee Templars, who, along with Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest and Albert Pike, the sovereign grand commander of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, founded the Ku Klux Klan in 1866. Now, these kids, they started out on this road as kids in 1915, and their direct intellectual descendants, their collaborators, and their friends have played a leading role in shaping the environment, which shapes the way that most of you here still think to a large extent, and that certainly conditions the way that most people in American culture think. They have provided the intellectual basis and the program for the upsurge of the influence of fundamentalist religious cults in political life over the last 70 years. And this includes both the Christian right and the upsurge in so-called New Age Aquarian-type cults. Put up the next slide. They are the direct intellectual leaders. They and their immediate students are the direct intellectual leaders of the so-called conservative revolution, associated with the names William F. Buckley, Newt Gingrich, and the other Southern Strategy Republicans. Next slide. They and their collaborators have also provided the ideological basis of the systems analysis connected one-worldist, pro-ecology, environmentalist, counterculture, freak movement, and the allied Southern Strategy Democrats. Next slide. They have provided the ideological framework for the bipartisan foreign strategic and economic policy, which goes under the headings globalization or Project Democracy, the idea of which is that all nation states ought to be subject to some sort of global authority in terms of their credit policies, economic development policies, military and technology policies. Next slide. They directly created and have led the leading school of literary criticism, which dominates the Modern Language Association, which is the professional association for all university and high school English teachers, literature professors, and so on, which sets standards for grammar as used in our major publications, book publications, newspapers, magazines, and so on. Through their connections with the Hollywood movie industry and elsewhere, they also have played a very influential role in influencing all of the institutions of so-called culture and entertainment typified by the Hollywood movie industry. What I hope to show tonight, and some of you have read my article on this in the EIR, most of you hopefully will, I can't go into a lot of detail. What I do hope to show is that for all of these seemingly disparate and, in fact, in some cases, seemingly conflicting institutions, political trends, and so on, there is one unifying idea. And to get an idea, to give you a sort of brief smell of what that idea is, I would refer you to H.G. Wells's novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is typical, frankly, of a whole genre of science fiction and literature, which involves the idea of the half-beast, half-man. The story of the Island of Dr. Moreau is the story of a fellow named Edward Prendick, who is somewhat like the author, H.G. Wells. He was a student of Charles Darwin's boss, Thomas Henry Huxley, who found himself stranded on a tropical island with Dr. Moreau and a lot of weird creatures. The weird creatures were animals that Dr. Moreau operated on in order to try to make them human. And he had some apparent success. They were able to talk. They were able to act as household servants. They were able to prepare food. They were able to speak relatively simply, sort of like a newscaster, a sportscaster, at about that level. Ultimately, the experiment didn't work, and the bestial, predatory nature of these animals came to the surface. And in due course, short course, really, it's a fairly short book, Dr. Moreau and his assistant perished at the hands of their experiments. Prendick escaped and returned to England, and as the novel concludes, Prendick in England said that as he looked at the people around him, he could not help feeling that he was still amongst the beat people of Dr. Moreau's island and that they might at any point turn on him the way that the creatures of the island had. And then he looked up to the heavens and he said, "I take comfort in thinking that there that within us which is more than animal-like can somehow, some way, be realized. Now, this, if you think about it, and I haven't given you many details, but it's actually clear from what Wells does with this book, is that this is the way he thought about it too, is the idea, for instance, of fundamentalist religion. Here, we're all beasts. Here, we're all predators. Here, you look out for number one. You look out for yourself, your family. Private enterprise, right? You want wealth? Well, let everybody look out for their own, and then we'll all have wealth, right? And we love God, of course. We love God up in heaven. Don't want him down in our neighborhood. We hope he won't come visit. But he's the most important thing to us. Now, so what you've got there, these fellows in 1915, which is the same year that evil twins were born in Hollywood through one act of birth, and that is the release of the first full-length Hollywood motion picture, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, the sales and distribution of which provided the initial financial base for developing the Hollywood movie industry, and also the circulation of which built the born-again Ku Klux Klan in the period 1915 and forward. One of the key figures in that, and there were many, but one I'll mention for this purpose, was a fellow named Walter L. Fleming, who was one of the leading insider historians of the Ku Klux Klan, who issued a book on that in 1905. A couple of years after the issuance of Birth of a Nation, he was named Dean of Vanderbilt University. The fellow in the bottom center there, John Crow Ransom, was the grandnephew of James Crow, who was one of Walter Fleming's chief sources. John Crow Ransom's mother, Ella, used to tell little Jimmy on her knee how she loved those good old days when she and the other Crow women would sit around the family hearth, sewing sheets together so the menfolk could go to their rallies. But they began in 1915 meeting with a Rosicrucian mystic named Sidney Metotrin Hirsch, who's the fellow there on the upper right with the beard. And what he schooled them in is what William Yandel Elliott, who's the fellow on the upper left there, we'll hear a touch more about him later, what he called the epic exemplar theory of history, which is basically your good old standard oligarchical religion, that you don't know anything except what some secret mysterious character may whisper to you. Sidney Hirsch apparently called them epic exemplars. You can find terms adepts, ascended masters, magi, little green men, as LaRouche calls them. This is the stuff that the Roman mystery religions, that Rosicrucian Freemasonry, theosophy, and so on, all of these things are made of. The key is you don't know nothing. But if you get on the inside with those of us that do know, well, then maybe you can make something of yourself. They became, in the 20s, famous leaders of the modernist poetry and literary movement. One of the key ways in which they became this was that William Yandel Elliott was one of about five of these good old boys from Nashville who became a Rhodes Scholar. In the early 20s, while they were publishing Fugitive magazine, he was listed as the editor in absentia. And he would stay up all night drinking with William Butler Yeats, the occultist poet, with Robert Graves, who's known to some of you as the author of the I, Claudius novels, which PBS did a famous television series on, and who also is known for his great work on the cult of the white goddess, the basis of all true religion. And the circles that they became prominent in were the circles of the bohemian generation of poets, the precursors of the beat and the hippie generation. fellow on the lower left there, Alan Tate, for instance, went to Paris and used to spend his Thursday afternoons with Gertrude Stein and her wife, Alice B. Toklas, eating hashish. No, I'm sorry. He claims he never ate the chocolate cake. And he claims that it was only served to the women in the back room because despite the fact that these fellows are, or whatever they are heroes of the gay rights movement, Gertrude Stein would not let Alice sit in the front room with the men. But they were upset at the treatment given the Southern culture by the literary elites. And in the late 20s, they resolved to do something about this, is to release a series of books. The centerpiece of this series is this, I'll Take My Stand, which is advertised here as the revolt of the young South against machine civilization. It was dedicated to Walter Fleming, the insider historian of the Ku Klux Klan. The publication of this collection was organized by Alan Tate in between his sessions at Gertrude Stein's in Paris, where he was also working on another one of the books released in this period, his biography of General Stonewall Jackson. To make it clear at the outset what this book was, I'll tell you what was said in its concluding essay. The concluding essay was written by Stark Young, who was the most famous at that point of the 12 agrarian authors. Now, Stark Young was in the middle of the movement of H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, and H.G. Wells' two main proteges, Aldous and Julian Huxley, in the United States. Young was on the editorial board of the H.G. Wells organ known as the New Republic, which still functions today as such. Also was a lifelong homosexual. What he wrote in his concluding essay is that the South saw the rise of a certain kind of aristocratic lifestyle. It was based on the copious ownership of land and many slaves. And that is what this book has been written about. And I just thought I would say that at the outset, because as these people went on and did other things, many people have tried to say that that book didn't say what it said and didn't mean what it meant. Now, specifically, what they painted in that book is this. They started by saying, all tend to support a Southern way of life against what may be called the American or prevailing way, agrarian versus industrial. Now, and they spelled out in some detail what they meant by that. And what they meant by that is that there's a terrible thing that happened to the human race as epitomized by the development of the United States of America. And that terrible thing was cognition. And that the way that things really ought to be is that people just should sort of lie there like turds on the ground and just sort of stay the same generation from generation to generation. And they, for instance, go back to what they liked about the Roman Republic. What they liked about the Roman Republic before the speculators and corn laws had driven men from the soil to the city slums was that they reeked of the soil, of the plow, and the spade. They had wrestled with virgin soil and forest. And they trace out that development through England, declaring that they are Anglophiles, and that they chiefly base themselves on the model of England. And I don't really think this is what happened in England, but what they say happened in England is that the English settled their country, figured out how to live in harmony with nature, made a truce with nature, and have lived the same way ever since. Whereas the American way makes an unrelenting war against nature, and it thrusts you into an infinite series of progress. You know, the idea that you might discover something, that you might figure out how to make improvements, that you might do that and then say, aha, we can do it even better. That's the infinite series of progress. They don't let us just lie alone. Why don't they leave us be? And I want to give you a little idea of what this means for cognition. This is from Robert Penn Warren, who ultimately became the most famous and successful of the group. Got two Pulitzer Prizes, had a couple of Hollywood movies made of his books, became the first poet laureate of the United States in 1986. And what I'm going to read you is a view that he held, which never really changed, although later in life he promoted himself as an advocate of civil rights, a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King. The Negro was as little equipped to establish himself, he's talking now of the freed slaves after the Civil War, was as little equipped to establish himself as he would have been to live again with spear and breech clout in the Sudan or Bantu country. The necessities of life had always found their way to his back or skillet without the least thought on his part. He did not know how to make a living. Always in the past, he had been told when to work and what to do. For what is the Negro to be educated? In the past, the Southern Negro has always been a creature of small town and farm. That is where he still chiefly belongs, by temperament and capacity. Some of you may think that that's a racist statement. Robert Penn Warren did not think so to his dying day. At the, a year before this book was published, he published a biography of the abolitionist John Brown, in which he said that one of the problems that led to the Civil War is that people in the North who had never really seen slavery for what it really was developed some theory about how it was evil, but that the slaves themselves never bothered their kinky heads about it. Because they had everything taken care of this. And to prove that this statement is not racist, I will read you from his friend, Alan Tate. Alan Tate, who was at that point called by T.S. Eliot the greatest poet writing in America, who later on was sent on tours by the CIA and the State Department to promote American culture abroad, wrote in I'll Take My Stand, "The South could remain simple-minded because it had no use for the intellectual agility required to define its position. The Southern mind was simple, not top-heavy with learning it had no use of. We are very near an answer to our question, how may the Southerner take hold of his tradition? The answer is by violence." A few years later, he wrote that he was a white supremacist, that he didn't like lynching, but that if you want to stop lynching, don't bother the people doing the lynching. It's very simple. Eliminate the fear of the whites that their supremacy will be challenged and lynching will stop. Also in this book, in an article by Andrew Nelson Lytle titled "The Hind Tit," Lytle wrote, "Prophets do not come from cities. They have always come from the wilderness, stinking of goats and running with lice." And I hope you're beginning to see a certain theme that's developing here about what sensations these fellows sort of like. At the same time, this great classic work was issued, Bedford Forrest and His Critter Company, which was a loving homage to the first imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Nathan Bedford Forrest. The point of that book, people have asked me, well, why is it called Nathan Bedford Forrest and the Critter Company? Well, it's about a cavalry outfit, and they've got horses and so on who are critters. But you look at the book, and what it talks about is the intelligence and wisdom of the members of the company, namely the horses. They'd perk their ears up. They'd sniff their noses. They'd sense what was coming next. Said a few things about the less intelligent members of the company on their backs, on the backs of the critters. And what he promulgated in this book is a very common myth about the founding of the United States, and one which is rampant to today in this conservative movement as well as in other circles. What he said is that, contrary to what we know, which is that the English colonization of the Americas was something that was led by the friends of William Shakespeare in order to get away from religious warfare in Europe, in order to have a relatively safe base from which to establish a sovereign nation, what Andrew Nelson Lytle writes is that the Forrests, like their friends who came to America, came to appease their nostalgia for feudalism. A few years before this, a fellow named Christopher Hollis, who was part of an English Catholic movement known as the Distributists, issued a book titled The American Heresy, in which he said essentially the same thing in some more detail, that America had been founded to be a feudal agrarian society, but that a heresy was introduced by Alexander Hamilton, Henry Carey, and Abraham Lincoln, which turned it instead into an industrial nation. And we'll hear more about the Distributists later. At the same time, a very important book, but one that you don't hear promoted as widely, was issued. It was titled God Without Thunder, written by John Crow Ransom, the white diaper baby you saw up there a little while earlier. What Ransom did in God Without Thunder is to give a detailed theological and philosophical explanation of the same ideas which were in I'll Take My Stand. What he says in that book is that we have a problem, which is that what he calls the God of the Old Testament, the God of Thunder, and let's say I don't think he's entirely accurate about his Old Testament interpretation, but we won't get into that now, because he's very clear about what he liked. A God that you were terrified of. A God like Jonathan Edwards' God. The God that is ready to stomp on you and let your blood splat all over his garments, because that's the way he shows his majesty. By not caring whether you are good or evil, not caring whether nations are good or evil, but he shows his majesty by stomping on the ones he doesn't like and raising up the ones he does like, just because that's the way he likes it.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll continue in a moment with more of Stanley Ezrell discussing the core of the Confederacy today. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Stanley Ezrell addressing the Schiller Institute conference on September 2, 2001.
That's Jonathan Edwards' God, and that is the God that John Crow Ransom mourns the loss of. Not because John Crow Ransom was a believer in that God or any God, as he makes clear, but as he says in the introductory letter, which is addressed to his guru, Sidney Matotrin Hirsch, he wishes to explain to the Western world of America the function of the myths in human civilization. How do you use myths to control people? Now, in developing his history of how it is that we turned away from this Godzilla God, he goes back as far as Plato. He describes the beginning of the development of Plato's idea of the idea of human cognition as the perilous step man had taken towards his later civilization when he introduced agriculture and ate of flesh. Here lay the origin of the strife between the animal species, when man began to enforce the fact of his superiority by militance and aggression. And then what he says is that what he likes are the fundamentalists. Why does he like the fundamentalists? Because the fundamentalist does not any longer distinguish myth and fact. But why should he, if the myth is worth believing in? And he also throws in a little bit of Sigma Tocqueville Hersch's training here, that what you really get ideas from are demons, which he says are the same as devils. That Socrates got his ideas from a demon and so on and so forth. That it's the demon that you get all of your ideas from. What John Crow Ransom complained about is the filioque as being the worst point in the history of the human race. Now, what's the filioque? Like Dr. Franklin, and unlike Elmer Gantry, I'm not dogmatic in matters of religion. But what the filioque was the idea that God, who is a Christ, who is man, shares in the creative capability of God in heaven. That God has the capability of understanding and furthering the understanding of the principles by which the universe was created. That's what John Crow Ransom did not like. That's what I do like, Lyndon LaRouche likes. It's what Nicholas of Cusa liked. It's what I believe Pope John Paul II likes about the filioque. Now, what John Crow Ransom did is to conclude his book with a programmatic call in which he said, well, what should we do about this? Some people might think that we should all join the Orthodox churches since they never accepted the filioque. And he said, but you know what kind of people they have in those churches? I would find that abhorrent. Well, why not forget Christ altogether and go back to the synagogue? Abhorrent! What about the Roman Catholic Church? Well, the West has been fighting against Rome. Well, what about the English Catholic, the Anglican, or the Episcopal churches? Well, now you're talking, I am an Anglophile, but no, I don't think Americans will buy it. So the call he ends with, which should sound like something familiar, something resembling something that maybe you've seen, is that whatever church you are in, turn it back to fundamentalism. Whatever church you are in, turn it away from the soft half man, half God. Turn it away from the God that you think can love you, from the God you think you can understand. Turn it away from what he describes Christ as the patron of science, and turn it back to the God of thunder, the God of terror. As I started to say before, out of this arose an alliance between the agrarians and these anti-Renaissance, pro-feudal Catholics known as the Distributists. The primary historical sympathy of the Distributists was with the Spanish Habsburgs, because just as they saw the Renaissance of the 15th century as being the worst disaster to befall man because of its promotion of this idea of the capability of the scientific efforts of man and so on. They saw the heroic efforts of Carlos V of Spain and especially of his son Philip II to destroy the Renaissance as being the most heroic struggle that traditional society had waged against what they described, and they would often describe the Renaissance as paganism because of its revival of Plato. Interestingly, Aristotle to these people was divine, but Plato was a pagan. Neither one of them, of course, were Christians. The This alliance involved the publication of an openly pro-fascist magazine called the American Review, which praised Hitler, Mussolini, propagandized against any attempt to militarily restrain the fascist and Nazi regimes. The key figures in the distributist movement were Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton. Belloc had written a book titled The Jews, and in the edition of that book, published in the period of his alliance with the agrarians in 1937, he said that he admired the heroic efforts of the Nazi regime to finally deal with the Jewish question, with his only concern being that their efforts would not provide a final solution for all of Europe. And just in fairness to Hilaire Belloc, he did not say that all Jews should be killed. What he did say is that a natural nation is one that is based on one ethnic grouping in one limited area, and that therefore no foreign ethnic group could be considered citizens of a nation, and that what the Jews ought to do is renounce citizenship in any non-Jewish nation that they were in, and then they could live in peace. Now, without going into further detail, this alliance of agrarians and distributists became somewhat unpopular in the course of the Second World War, but it was revived immediately after the Second World War, and it was revived under the patronage of the pro-feudalist Catholic Buckley family, William F. and all of his brothers and so on. What we know as the conservative movement associated with Buckley includes amongst its ideological figures the following people who are direct students of the agrarians: Richard Weaver, Melvin E. Bradford, Frederick Wilhelmson, Russell Kirk, Wilmore Kendall, then the next generation student, Thomas Fleming. These are the people who wrote and directed the Buckleyite publications, including Modern Age, the Journal of Buckley's Intercollegiate Studies Institute, National Review, Chronicles, which is the Journal of the Rockford Institute, and so on. What you see there is evidence of a now existing typical product of the agrarian distributist alliance. This is from the website of Christendom College in Front Royal, Virginia, which bills itself as America's premier Catholic college. It was founded with Buckley money. It has a student lounge and billiard hall named Chester Belloc, after the pro-Nazi distributists G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc. What you see there is an announcement for a program on liturgical music held last June, featuring Thomas Fleming, who was a founder of the pro-Ku Klux Klan, pro-Confederate Southern Partisan magazine, a founder of the pro-Ku Klux Klan, pro-Confederate Southern Patriot magazine, who is a board member of the League of the South, who is an open advocate for a new secession of the Confederacy, and who works in alliance with separatist organizations in the Balkans, in Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, who are attempting, using terrorists and other means, to destroy nation states wherever they can. So there, what we've gone over so far, just to recap, is the influence of the agrarians. One thing that I hope you have sort of detected and picked up is that taking away certain kind of drawl, taking away certain kinds of references to Negroes and so on, their views on technology, science, and the environment are no different from Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, no different from Fat Albert Gore, no different from this entire movement, who take any idea and propose any idea that may seem good and propose that it's the most dangerous thing that's hit us. Now, what most historians of the agrarians claim is that this political episode in the 30s was temporary, that they gave it up, they abandoned it, and they went on to brilliant literary careers, And here you just see the scene at the Library of Congress, where you've got John Crow Ransom, Cleanth Brooks sitting on the left, their friend Eudora Welty in the middle. And, you know, I won't go into detail now, but they dominated the whole Library of Congress literary apparatus. They got prizes. They decided who else got the prizes and so on. Now, what I want to do is briefly look at what the new criticism is, which I think you will agree with me after hearing it. I was absolutely right to call the new criticism. And you can see how different it is from agrarianism. First, give you an idea of what they don't like. I'll just read to you from John Crow Ransom's most famous essay of literary criticism, Shakespeare at Sonnets, in which he attacks Shakespeare for being a careless workman because he violated some of the rules of English sonnet writing, which John Crow Ransom invented 300 years after Shakespeare's death. And this is what he had to say about Shakespeare otherwise, when taking objection to Shakespeare's reference to the soul of the wide dreaming world. "The world soul is a technical concept, I suppose, in the sense that it was of use to Paracelsus and to other theosophists. It indicates a very fine image for some metaphysical poet who will handle it technically, for Donne or another university poet. It is not fit for amateurs. The question is whether Shakespeare's theological touch here is not amateurish. Elsewhere, it sometimes is, as in Hamlet's famous soliloquy, beginning to be or not to be." Now, what underlay this view of Shakespeare is the following. "We have elected to know the world through science, but science is only the cognitive department of our animal life, and by it we know the world only as a scheme of abstract conveniences. What we cannot know constitutionally as scientists is the world which is made up of whole and indefeasible objects. And this is the world which poetry recovers for us. Science gratifies a practical impulse and exhibits the minimum of perception. Art gratifies a perceptual impulse and exhibits the minimum of reason." In case that wasn't clear, I'll read you briefly a letter to Alan Tate, his friend. "Biologically, man is peculiar in that he must record and use his successive experiences. The beasts are not under this necessity. With them, the experience is an end in itself and takes care of itself." Now, what I'll just ask you to think about is what he is saying is that the role of poetry, of literature, of all art, is to take that impulse in you toward reason, toward cognition, toward science, and make sure that it gets directed back toward that part of you that you share with the beasts. The five senses, and you know which is the favorite, and the appetites. Now, as I said, these fellows realized that some of their views were getting unpopular in the late 40s. William Yandell Elliott, who at that point was the head of the Harvard Government Department, who had written a number of books, including The New British Empire and The Need for Constitutional Reform, about the need to turn the United States into a government based on a permanent bureaucracy tied to a nobility, as was beloved Britain, joined with Herbert Agar, who was another collaborator of the agrarians, and also with Bertrand Russell's agent in the United States, Robert Maynard Hutchins, and a number of other people who you would tend to identify as being sort of leftists, like the novelist Thomas Mann, in issuing a book in 1940 called The City of Man, A Declaration of World Democracy, which was an appeal for the United States to join the war effort in defense of beloved Britain, but only on very special terms. namely, that the war be used to destroy all nations and to establish a new government of a particular sort. And I'll read you a little bit from that. The war must guarantee that the heresy of nationalism is conquered and the absurd architecture of the present world is finally dismantled. And what they want to get away from are these nations based on ideas and back to a situation in which each nation rises from the natural conditions of each one's soil. They want to stop the blind effects of the overgrowth of the machine age. Under whose authority should this be? Godzilla's. In this case, they name it the Holy Ghost. They call the Holy Ghost the head of the new religion of democracy. And they quote scripture in defense of this view, saying, "Blasphemy against the Holy Ghost shall not be forgiven unto men." They want a New Testament of Americanism in which all institutions must now be controlled, and they list them: family, education, neighborhood, and church. All must come under the dictatorial control of their new Holy Ghost for the crime of meddling in the anarchy of nations. This they refer to as the pruning of the tree of freedom, in order to make it more fruitful. And they demand that this government be enforced through having one military and police authority on the earth. This is not a science fiction movie. This is something that was pushed by people. And after the war, William Yandel Elliott served on Dwight Eisenhower's National Security Council. He served on a number of commissions which helped reorganize the government, moving toward the kind of permanent bureaucracy, bringing in non-elected extra-constitutional bodies like the National Security Council, the National Economic Council, and so on. So that this was something which was an active idea, and to the extent that you know something about what is today called Project Democracy and Globalization, under which flag the United States, Britain, and so on will overthrow elected leaders like Fujimori of Peru in the name of democracy because he fought the drug trade. We will attempt to overthrow Mahathir of Malaysia because he attempted to defend the currency of his nation. This is an idea which is being put into practice. Now, in a moment, I'm going to let you listen to what William Yandel Elliott said. What you're going to hear are remarks which he made to the Fugitive Reunion in 1956, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. At that point, as I said, he was on Dwight Eisenhower's National Security Council. He was working very closely with his prime protege, Dr. Henry Kissinger. He had co-authored with Kissinger Western Political Heritage, which had become the main Western Civilization textbook for training all of Harvard's freshmen and so on. And he and Kissinger together had hosted something called the Harvard International Summer Seminars, which brought world leaders in who showed some promise in order to indoctrinate them. And the fugitives were often the people that were invited to be the guest lecturers at these summer seminars. Kissinger, up through 1963, as the hosts of these seminars, continued to work directly with people like Alan Tate, Andrew Nelson Lytle, who were brought in there. Elliott had founded a literary magazine, Confluence, to be edited by his protege, Kissinger. Alan Tate, the agrarian, served on the editorial board with him. Earlier in remarks that I'm not going to play for you, Elliott said that he had often brought gatherings of fugitives up to Harvard to do poetry programs and so on. So play the first segment of the tape.
Like the Johnny Ransom bid in this group, and I may be forgiven for speaking of it as one who certainly from the earliest time profited by his immediate friendship, as well as his teaching. It was to set a model of gentility, of courtesy, of detachment and fairness. Johnny today is a national and an international figure. He's been honored in many, many ways, but I suppose no honor has ever meant more to him than coming back here tonight. And I felt that in the words that he said so simply and rightly at the dinner this evening, given in his honor as much as any other person or more in the fugitive group. We would all accord him that right.
Now that, of course, was Bill Elliott on the upper left there and Johnny Crow Ransom in the center bottom. And, of course, this is John Crow Ransom of God Without Thunder. John Crow Ransom of Cognition is the biggest enemy in the history of the human race, who he's talking about. Now let's hear the next tape segment.
I can't forbear to mention the name of Sidney Hirsch,
upper right.
A mystic, a philosopher, a rather unusual and well-schooled man, because he was one of the great philosophical forces, and surely one of the contributing forces to the fugitive group.
Now that, of course, is Sidney Hirsch, who I told you about. At the point when, as William Yandel Elliott said, he and others went to Sidney Hirsch's home and brought him back, I've seen a published article on this and interviewed some people in Nashville at the time. Sidney Hirsch lived alone. He had a club chair, an overstuffed chair that he liked to sit on while he talked to guests. There was a human pelvis hanging from the ceiling above the chair, which he would stroke as he talked to them. There was a life-size nude portrait of himself behind the chair, and it was filled with various artifacts of oriental mystical significance. And remember, just as Sidney Hirsch, as William Yandel Elliott called Sidney Hirsch one of the most powerful intellectual influence on his life, Henry Kissinger said of William Yandel Elliott that he owed more to him, both intellectually and humanly, than to any man he had known. Another one of his proteges was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the leading guru of Democratic Party foreign policy, the fellow that discovered Jimmy Carter, brought him into the Trilateral Commission, and made him President of the United States. Both Kissinger and Brzezinski are now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies together, which has been one of the major think tanks in developing military and other foreign strategic policy for the so-called post-détente era. CSIS is the think tank that in the early 80s brought together Al Gore, Newt Gingrich, Brent Scowcroft, and others of that ilk in order to formulate what they called the horses and rabbits strategy. The strategy that says that the advanced nations are the horses above the battle, and we have allies as well as enemies who are the rabbits who fight and die for us on the ground. And just what I want to do before concluding is remind you of a famous address made in furtherance of this strategy by Dr. Henry Kissinger, May 10, 1982, to the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And hopefully you will recognize in this his intellectual debt to the fugitives and the agrarians. What he said is, many American leaders condemn Churchill as needlessly obsessed with power politics, too rigidly anti-Soviet, too colonialist, and too little interested in building the fundamentally new international order towards which American idealism always tended. The dispute was resolved according to American preferences, in my view, to the detriment of post-war security. Fortunately, Britain had a decisive influence over America's rapid awakening to maturity in the years following. In my White House incarnation then, I kept the British Foreign Office better informed and more closely engaged than I did the American State Department. So there you have it. You may have to review some of the material. You may have to think about it. But what you've got dominating the political thinking of both of our parties, of our educational, cultural, and entertainment institutions, and many of our religious institutions, particularly many of our religious institutions that tend to be prominent in politics, is the idea that your minds, your ability to use your minds in the way that we've been discussing throughout this weekend, your cognitive capabilities are an evil to be extirpated, and that you really would be much happier down on all fours, like a dachshund dragging your nose, sniffing for turds. And if you think about it, I would imagine you would recognize that many of you and many of the people that you know psychologically are in that state a lot of the time. Keep your head down. Keep out of trouble. Now, what I would propose is that you keep your head up and keep in trouble. The air is a lot fresher, and you can see a lot further. So have fun. Are we not human?
This has been EIR Talks, presenting Stanley Ezrall, speaking on the topic of the Confederacy today. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.